That was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting a possible nuclear test by North Korea. An earthquake that appears to have been man-made near a known nuclear testing site in North Korea was detected by several monitoring agencies Wednesday. If confirmed, this would be the fourth such nuclear test by North Korea. The U.S. Geological Survey reported a 5.1 magnitude quake. China's Earthquake Network Center described the unusual seismic activity as a suspected explosion. The South Korean news agency Yonhap said the foreign ministry in Seoul was holding an emergency meeting. One U.S. member was killed and two wounded Tuesday during fighting in Afghanistan's Helmand province. U.S. defense officials said American Special Forces units were involved in an operation near the city of Marja. Here is Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook.
This is an ongoing situation. There is still a fight going on in the immediate surroundings.
The U.S. soldier killed Tuesday was not identified. Authorities Tuesday recovered the bodies of at least 36 migrants who drowned off the coast of Turkey after their boats overturned in rough waters. The migrants were trying to reach Greece. 12 of them were rescued. The UN mission in the Central African Republic says it is investigating new allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeepers and international forces in the country's capital. The mission known as MINUSCA did not specify the allegations in Tuesday's statement, but said staff from the UN Children's Fund have met with four alleged victims, all girls, and are helping them obtain medical care and assessing their psychological needs. This is VOA News. The Israeli military said a Palestinian stabbed a soldier Tuesday in the West Bank. The attacker was then shot and killed by troops. The attack was the latest in what has been a near daily event of Palestinian attacks. Those attacks have left more than 20 Israelis dead in the last 3 months. India's defense minister said Tuesday a total of 6 militants have been killed after an attack on an airbase in northern India. He said the effort to secure the site is still ongoing. As countries and militias line up behind regional power players, Iran and Saudi Arabia, analysts say the diplomatic crisis is already having an impact in the region. Heather Murdoch has more.
Kuwait is the latest Sunni-dominated country to withdraw its ambassador from Iran, following Bahrain, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates, which have all either cut ties or downgraded their relationships with Iran following an international dispute over Saudi Arabia's execution of Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr. After the Saturday execution, the Saudi embassy in Tehran was attacked, and Saudi Arabia severed diplomatic ties. Heather Murdoch, Cairo.
U.S. President Barack Obama has announced a series of measures meant to reduce gun violence, bypassing Congress on an issue that has sharply divided the American public. Mr. Obama rolled out the new policies Tuesday during a White House address where he chided lawmakers for failing to enact tighter gun control measures despite a wave of mass shootings.
We are the only advanced country on earth that sees this kind of mass violence erupt with this kind of frequency. It doesn't happen in other advanced countries.
The executive actions will require more gun sellers to get licenses and more gun buyers to undergo background checks. The measures will also tighten enforcement of existing gun laws, increase mental health treatment, and expand research into gun safety technology. Anti-government activists pressed on with their occupation of a wildlife refuge in the northwestern U.S. state of Oregon on Tuesday. The father and son at the center of the group's protest are now distancing themselves from the activists. What had begun as a splinter group from peaceful protests backing the local ranchers turned into a four-day standoff focused on larger complaints about the way the federal government manages the land it owns, especially in the West. Peace talks between Burundi's government and the nation's opposition groups have been postponed. There's been no word on when they may resume. The talks, which opened in Uganda late last month, were set to continue Wednesday in Tanzania. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes were up at the close of trade today. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 6th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Burundi peace talks scheduled to resume in Tanzania today have been postponed indefinitely.
We had already indicated that our government was not concerned by the date of the 6th of January because the date was set without consulting us. So it was very clear from day one that we are not going to go to any place, whether it is Arusha or Dar es Salaam or Nairobi.
Alain Yamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. The fight for Libya's oil installations continues into its second day, Tuesday. Cameroonians welcome a ban on toy guns. And Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf announces her support for a reduction in the presidential term from 6 to 4 years.
She has, in fact, written a legislature, and she has asked them to actually consider to amend the Constitution, the presidential term, that it can be limited to 2 4-year terms.
Louis Brown is Liberia's information minister. Zimbabwe's government hikes traffic fines to raise revenue, and an African-flavored comic book made in Nigeria. The stories plus Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Peace talks between Burundi's government and opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. The talks, which opened in Uganda late last month, were set to continue today, Wednesday, in Arusha, Tanzania. Now, Burundi's Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says the government will not participate because the January 6th date was set by mediators without consulting with the Burundian government.
We had already indicated that our government was not concerned by the date of the 6th of January because the date was set without consulting us. So it was very clear from day one that we are not going to go to any place, whether it is Arusha or Dar es Salaam or Nairobi, on the 6th of January because of that reason.
But did you make this concern to, say, President Museveni of Uganda or the East African community?
We released a communique on the 28th of December from Kampala stating our position clearly and loudly that on January the 6th, Burundi government will not be part of whatever appointment that will be set. Because the decision, as it appeared in the communique released by the facilitation, was not an agreed-upon decision.
As I was saying to you, Mr. Minister, this is information from John Minani of Fredebu, saying essentially that it's not for your government to decide who the opposition should be negotiating with, accusing your government of not wanting to negotiate because you know that you are the cause of all the problems in Burundi.
His job is about criticizing government. His job is about calling the government names. His job is all about finding a reason of existence. Now, is it the government that is organizing rebel groups in DRC? Is it not Minani, who has been cited by many former soldiers of Burundi for recruitment and training in Rwanda and Eastern DRC? So why is he trying to divert the attention that the international community is actually starting to put on his name and his group? It is correct that the government, once we are invited, will take part in the talks. That's correct. But it is not also without sense to say that whenever we go for talks, we go by the book, we follow Resolution 2248, which calls the government and all interested peaceful stakeholders to take part in that dialogue. If he believes that he, Minani, and his group, they are peaceful stakeholders, then they have nothing to fear.
So, Mr. Minister, as things stand, we don't know when the talks are going to resume, yet the African Union has said that it will sanction anyone whose actions jeopardize the dialogue.
Yes, we know of the threat of sanctions by the African Union, but we also have to understand that we're talking about a process. If indeed parties or a party is obstructing willingly the dialogue process, that I would understand that they will come up with a number of sanctions. But let's not forget that there was a resolution which was passed by the UN Security Council on the 12th of November last year, which called on the government and all interested peaceful stakeholders to engage in a constructive, inclusive dialogue. Now, if some of the groups that are invited around the table are not peaceful, how then do you believe that that resolution will be respected?
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says she supports the call by Liberians to reduce the presidential time in office from 6 to 2 4-year term. Currently, the president of Liberia can only serve a 2 6-year term. A constitutional review commission set up by President Sirleaf recommended last year to reduce the presidential tenure in office. The commission also recommended the term of office for senators be reduced from the current 9 years to 6 and representatives from 6 to 4 years. Information Minister Louise Brown says President Sirleaf's support to change the presidential term to 4 years is part of her effort to build a democratic governance model that is transparent and that every Liberian can feel a part of.
She has, in fact, written a legislature, and she has asked them to actually consider to amend the Constitution, the presidential term, rather than what it is today, which is 2 6-year terms, that it can be limited to 2 4-year terms. In effect, a maximum of 8 years rather than a maximum allowable term of 12 years for a president. And the same will be applied to the legislature. So she is asking that the House of Senate, rather than what it is right now for 9 years per senator, that it will be reduced to 6 years. And for members of the House, it is for 6 years currently that it be reduced to 4. And they can run as many times as they wish.
As you know, Mr. Brown, all around Africa, there's this movement against presidents who are trying to change constitutions to increase their term limits or to maintain themselves in power. I'm sure she has been following what's happening in other countries. Is she in favor of the people continuing in office, or does she feel that a president serving 2 terms is enough?
Well, if her example is anything to go by, then certainly it speaks to the fact that she will favor presidential term limits. Now, whether she's sending a message to the rest of Africa, I am not in a position to say. But I know that her entire leadership has been around making sure that Liberia is best positioned, whether it be through economic transformation, whether it be through political transformation, so that every citizen feels a duty to their country in the first instance, and that we can deepen the institutional capacities of our society to build the kind of democratic governance model that is a bit more transparent, a bit more accountable to the people, and that Liberians over the longer term can sustain their peace.
There were several recommendations that were adopted at the Constitutional Review Conference in last year. Among those is the one recommendation which I think is asking for dual citizenship. Some Liberians have rejected that, and I think the president is in favor of dual citizenship. Why?
It is not in the best interest of our country to alienate people who were born to Liberian parentage, people who are truly Liberians. And she used other economic indicators that dual citizenship has had a positive impact on the economy, especially at a time when we need to continue to invest in our country.
Louis Brown is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today's Wednesday, January 6th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Libyan television reported Tuesday a resumption of fighting around the oil export port of Sidra between fighters claiming loyalty to the Islamic State group and Libya's Petroleum Infrastructure Force. As Edward Urania reports from Cairo, 7 people were killed and 25 wounded during battles on Monday.
Fire raged at a petroleum storage tank in Sidra Tuesday, struck by a missile reportedly fired by Islamic State militants west of the town. Another oil storage tank was set ablaze in nearby Ras Lanuf Monday after Islamic State attacked forces protecting the facility. Mohamed al-Harari, a spokesman for the Libyan National Oil Company in Tripoli, told Libya Likol al-Ahrar TV that fighting was preventing firefighters from quelling the flames. He said that fire and smoke continued to pour from a 500,000-barrel crude oil storage tank in Sidra and a pipeline between tanks. He adds that fire crews with the Waha Oil Company, which operates the port, have been unable to tackle the fires due to ongoing clashes. Militants claiming allegiance to the Islamic State group attacked Ras Lanuf Monday with rockets and multiple suicide car bombs, killing at least 7 oil company security guards. Islamic State later reportedly withdrew to the nearby town of Benjavad. Libya's oil triangle near the eastern capital, Benghazi, is the country's most valuable economic asset. Competing militias control vast swaths of territory and are beyond the control of the 2 rival governments vying for dominance. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, says that gaining control of Libya's oil facilities could give Islamic State major clout over the rest of the country.
The Libyans know that whoever controls the country's oil can control Libya. Now, I don't think ISIS has a chance of controlling the country's resources, because sentiment, be it either in the east or the west, is averse to ISIS. The real threat is Al-Qaeda.
Kashan argues that Libyans will side with Al-Qaeda against Islamic State, and in due time, they will turn against Al-Qaeda. He also stresses that Libyans, for the most part, are not militant Islamists. Libya's oil production has reportedly fallen to less than a quarter of the 1.6 million barrels per day it averaged before the start of the 2011 revolt against the late Muammar Gaddafi. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Zimbabwean government has put in place new ways of raising revenue to coincide with the new year. Traffic fines have increased by at least 100%, and the fine for running a red light has jumped from $20 to $100. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare.
Zimbabwe's natural resources, such as gold, platinum, and diamonds, have failed to make the country's economy tick. Now the government is turning to another source to raise funds, traffic fines. Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa hiked fines for speeding, running red lights, and other infractions by 100% or more as of January 1st. This is the first time in Zimbabwe's history that fines have been used to generate revenue for the government. Tawanda Majoni, an independent analyst in Harare, says it is clear the government is desperate for money.
It has been struggling to pay civil servants. It has been struggling to fund key projects. And apparently it's looking at the issue of fines as one way of raising revenue. But that's a very desperate and sorry way of doing that. What government is actually doing is to look at crime as a source of income.
In the streets, motorists urged President Mugabe to reconsider the new traffic fines.
It's not fair. They should reduce those fees. $100 fine.
Cannot afford is a common phrase in Zimbabwe, given that most of the population is unemployed. That is the view of Chris Madamombe, a public transport driver.
The fines are not reasonable. It's caused a lot of corruption with the police officers.
From here, Madamombe slips into the Shona language, saying police would be asking for some cash if they see that I cannot afford the new fines. On Monday, Finance Minister Chinamasa told journalists that the new traffic fines would stand regardless of criticism of the idea. Few, if any, Zimbabweans seem to think that traffic fines can get money flowing to the treasury again and turn the economy around. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The government of Cameroon announced last month a ban on the importation, sale, and use of toy guns. Officials say the ban is aimed at discouraging violence and improving public safety. Many people are applauding the ban, and some want the parliament to make it into a law. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
9-year-old Kennedy Afubai uses his electronic Kalashnikov toy gun to shoot at objects at St. Anastasie, a popular park and tourist attraction in the heart of Yaoundé, Cameroon's capital. The toy gun sprays little water-filled balloons when Kennedy pulls the trigger.
As you can see, I'm using my Kalashnikov gun to shoot and kill enemies so they should not continue attacking us. I'll kill all of them.
It's that kind of talk that makes many Cameroonians nervous, especially since the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram has carried out several massacres in far northern Cameroon. Elvira Tomo is the 35-year-old mother of three girls. She says she prefers toys that, for example, look like kitchen utensils.
Je n'achète pas les armes parce que je n'ai pas joué avec les armes à mon âge.
She says she will never buy toy guns because they teach children violence and that her parents never bought toy guns for her. She says a child who is offered a toy gun will eventually desire a real gun, which is dangerous for the society. Cameroon announced the ban on toy guns last month, shortly before the end of year feast, when people exchange gifts and buy toys for children. Mani Jedone, an official charged with implementing the ban at Cameroon's Ministry of Territorial Administration, says officials made the decision because of the increasing threat of gun violence in the Central African nation. He says in one case, replica guns were used to commit armed robbery.
A family in Douala was harassed, and at the end, when the police arrested them, they noticed that they had the toy guns, because the family had very little time to notice or to look at what the criminals were holding. They surrendered all they had.
Cameroon's National Commission on Human Rights and Freedoms has saluted the initiative and is asking for additional efforts to make sure the ban is effective. There are still no laws on the books banning the use of toy guns in Cameroon. Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Growing up in Nigeria, Jidet Mountain will often ask himself, what would Superman do when the young boy was faced with a problem? Today, he wants young people in Africa to be able to ask themselves, what would Guardian Prime do? Guardian Prime is one of 9 African superheroes who are part of the Comic Republic's lineup of characters. Martin launched Comic Republic in 2013 because he thought there should be more comics that also showcase Black and African characters. Of the 9 feature heroes dubbed Africa's Adventures by some fans, 4 of them are female. Martin tells Ricky Schreier that since the launch of the comic, they have seen their monthly online issue grow from hundreds of downloads each month to 25,000 last month.
I think the demand for African comics is new. People really like stuff that is new. It almost feels like a fresh start. Also, you're not used to seeing a comic book that's just basically African. When I mean African, I mean, you know, Black folk. Most of our comics are dominated by white people, which is not a bad thing, in my opinion, but let's take it differently. I mean, being a hero doesn't have to mean they're mostly white. They could come from anywhere in the world, and that's why we're like, okay, you know what? Imagine we had our own superheroes in Africa.
Could you tell me a little bit about your inspiration for making these African-inspired characters?
Basically, for me, it's more like, you know, we're in the generation where morals are really low. People don't really believe in the icons of old, you know, things like religion, traditions don't really mean anything anymore. It was a point where I thought, okay, you know what? When I was growing up, things were a lot better. And I was thinking, what did I used to use to make my own decision? And I remember clearly that whenever I wanted to do something, I was like, what would Superman do? What would Batman do? And, you know, I was like, okay. That's because I read comics. I thought, why don't I use that same medium to, you know, like, create like some kind of moral code. Heroes are supposed to be iconic and basically they inspire young people. And nowadays, even old people too.
I think one of the most interesting things about these African Avengers, the feature in your comics, is that I believe you have gender equality in the comics, and you said that that kind of just happened because naturally you didn't do it on purpose. But could you talk about that a little bit more? Because in comparison to more Western-based comics, that's actually quite rare.
Funny enough, where I'm from, Western Nigeria, we don't have the problem with, you know, women inequality, at least where I'm from. It's not something we think about. We love our women. We consider them equals. We thought, why not? Why not female superheroes? I mean, they're better looking.
Do you have any female artists who work for the comic book? I believe you're a 9-person team.
No, we don't have any female person that draws, that does illustrations. But our head of marketing and corporate communication, yes, she's female.
You said that some of what the characters do in the comic is work for a better, safer Africa, to improve Nigeria. Do you touch on any current events in your comics?
Because we're a startup, we're trying to play safe. That's the honest truth. It's not like we don't want to touch on major issues. So we're sticking to science fiction for now. And the reason why we're doing that is because we still want to become a household name.
Judith Martin, founder of Comic Republic, speaking to Ricky Stryak from Lagos, Nigeria. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. The World Athletics Championship silver medalist Habiba Gribi is Tunisia's 2015 Sportswoman of the Year. Gribi was a clear winner in the poll conducted by the Tunisian media and private sector in Tunis. Gribi was runner-up in the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase at the World Championships in Beijing, China. She went on to set a new Africa women's 3,000-meter steeplechase record of 9 minutes and 5.35 seconds at the IAAF Diamond League in Brussels, Belgium. Staying in Tunis, judoka Faisal Jabala is Tunisia's 2015 Sportsman of the Year. Jabala earned the accolade for bagging a gold medal at the Africa Open Judo Championship staged in Tunis and a gold medal at the Grand Slam in Samsun, Turkey. Jabala also clinched a bronze medal at the Grand Slam in Budapest, Hungary. Turning to football, suspended FIFA Secretary-General Jerome Valcke faces a possible ban of 9 years from all football activities, FIFA revealed in Zurich, Switzerland on Tuesday. FIFA suspended Valcke from all football activities for 90 days in September following his alleged inappropriate conduct regarding World Cup ticket sales. The suspension expired on Monday. On concluding their work, the FIFA Ethics Committee's investigatory chamber on Tuesday has recommended to the FIFA Ethics Committee's adjudicatory chamber that Valcke be banned from football for 9 years and pay a fine of over $100,000. Meanwhile, on a happier note, Nigeria play Angola in the South African capital Tshwane as Rwanda host the Democratic Republic of Congo in Gisenyi in friendly matches today, Wednesday. These are build-up matches ahead of the African Nations Championships starting in Kigali, Rwanda next week. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The UN mission in the Central African Republic says it is investigating new allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeepers and international forces in the country's capital. And that's it for this Wednesday, January 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Wednesday.
Next on Reporters Roundtable. Join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable. I'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the big events in Africa in the year 2015. So please join us on Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.